Good morning. Welcome. My name is Sharon, and I serve the village as education coordinator. And it's my privilege to introduce Justin Figgins. Justin is a neuroscientist, but now a software developer, correct? I learned that last night. Who developed software for other scientists to analyze data. Did I get that right?
Yeah.
Justin and his wife, Kara, are here for 2 weeks, and their two children are enjoying Narnia this morning, as are their parents, right? So he's going to be leading a series of sessions on wild brains, and this morning it's Where Is That? So thank you, Justin.
Thank you, Sharon. Awesome. Thank you all for coming. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you all for coming this morning.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent many years studying animal brains, and my latest career transition, I'm helping other scientists to do cool work. But I'm very excited to be here to share a little bit about some of the amazing things that animals do, some of the challenges that they face in their lives, which I think that we have some familiarity with ourselves. There's a lot of commonalities in how we have to get around the world, and how animals have similar challenges, and in some places have come to similar ways of addressing those challenges, and some different ways of addressing those challenges. So in this session today, we're going to be talking about how animals find things in their environment, particularly with sound. My own training was as a auditory neuroscientist mostly, and I have a real passion for music and speech and language and audition and how we use sound. So you might sense a strong bias in the stuff that I'm talking about coming right back to sound. So for anything, and feel free to interrupt at any time. Anytime during the session, if there's anything I'm talking about that's not clear, or if you have any questions.
Cold weather and a blanket of snow have left her short of food. So she's been forced to hunt in the day. And now she's got competition. A kestrel. It's one of the downsides of hunting during the daylight hours. And even worse, the snow means she can't see her prey. So how do you find your food when it's hiding out of sight? Hunger forces the kestrel to take a chance. But his razor-sharp eyesight isn't enough in these conditions. Luckily for the barn owl, she has another superpower in her armory. Flying blind won't stop her eating. Because although she can't see it, she can hear her prey, even under the snow. The kestrel simply doesn't have what it takes. So
I love this idea. Owls are amazing with sound localization. And what we'll talk about a little bit is how incredibly specialized they are how incredibly specialized owls are for these challenges that they face. Overall in the talk today, we're gonna touch on sort of questions of what do sounds tell us about where they're coming from and where we're listening to them, and we'll talk a little bit about how owls, crickets, and bats use different cues to find their food, to find to find mates. And in general, I think that what I'd like us to reflect on a little bit is again, what are the kind of shared experiences that we have with these animals, and what are kind of the unique experiences that we have in facing these challenges? So as you were watching that video, and if you reflect a little bit, do you guys have any ideas? What kinds of information was the owl using to try to figure out where that little mouse was under the snow?
Some kind of movement.
Some kind of movement?
Because you hear that, if you have really
heard
it. Yeah. I suspect.
Yeah. And how do they know that it was that movement was here and not over there? Can you so right now I'm talking to you, but my voice isn't coming from me, it's coming, right? You're hearing it from those speakers, right? So there's different cues and different sounds of where these things come from. If I muffle my voice a little bit, right, that gives you information that this sound source is now behind something, right? So one of the way that a lot of, David Marr was a neuroscientist a number of decades ago, and he kind of, he proposed a framework that scientists and neuroscientists and behavioral psychologists have been using for many years that I think is very useful for framing some of the problems and how we think about some of these challenges. And Marr broke this up into sort of levels of analysis, levels at which we can think about these challenges. His three levels are a level of computation. So what is the actual computation that needs to be made, in order to solve some kind of a challenge? What is the algorithm for that computation? Like what is the way that one can determine what that can actually do that computation? And then what is the actual implementation in biology of that algorithm? So the top two, so this idea of a computation and algorithm, these are abstract concepts. You can sketch these out with math, you can sketch these out with drawing arrows on a piece of paper, and then the actual implementation is what has actually happened in the biology. And so when we think about sound localization, what the challenge basically comes down to is that we have two ears. We have two ears, and there are different signals that are reaching each of our ears. And these two signals are slightly different from one another because of the distance between our ears. So there are a few different things that might change. So if you imagine that those two arrows there are is the sort of the same sound that's far away that's coming to this head. What kinds of things might be different between those two arrows but by the time they reach the ears?
The time they get there.
The time they get there, yeah.
Distance.
That distance.
Volume.
And the volume. So these two things, so this distance and volume, they're the timing and volume by virtue of the distance, ends up being some of these very major cues for localization. So, first of all, on the... Can you guys see that little red light?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
So on the left-hand side here, it's kind of an illustration that you know, by virtue of this distance, it's going to take a longer time for the sound to get to this left ear than it does to the right ear. And also, because the head itself causes a bit of a shadow, so as sound travels through air and goes through further distance, the volume decreases. And then the actual like muffling of the head, the sound shadow of the head on the left ear causes the left ear to be even quieter by virtue of that shadow. So we end up with two major differences between the left ear and the right ear, and that is the delay in time between the left ear and the right ear for the exact same sound wave to reach the left ear and reach the right ear. And the difference in volume, that the left ear ends up getting a quieter sound than the right ear. And over again, these two main cues are used by animals, by humans, as evidence for sound localization in order to localize where the left and right sounds are. sounds that are off to our left or off to our right. So one of the, we're gonna focus right now a little bit on this time difference. One of the interesting things for humans is that, it varies a lot for different animals. But for humans, for example, we end up relying very heavily on amplitude in high frequencies, and we end up relying very heavily on the time delay for lower frequencies. And that basically has to do with the way that our ears are spaced and how reliable the different cues are at different frequency ranges. But if we focus a little bit on the left side, back in, back in the 40s or so, this researcher Jeffress proposed a model for how time delays might be encoded, what type of an algorithm would account for being able to do these time delays. And what he proposed is that basically you've got information coming from the left ear, and then information coming from the right ear, and a bunch of coincidence detectors. And so these detectors would respond, would be active, or report out somehow if the sound hit both of them at the same time. So if the sound is dead ahead, straight ahead of me, then my response starts coming in here, and at 1 millisecond or something, one little chunk of time in, this guy, the sound is here at the same time it is here, and neither of these coincidence detectors goes off. A little bit later, both of these hit, and they don't go off. And then a bit later, both sounds come and trigger this coincidence detector, and this one goes off. And so by virtue of knowing which of these detected the simultaneous sound, that then says, okay, well, there was no time delay, and so this sound was dead ahead. This sound was right ahead of me. Whereas if the sound was off to my left, then this one would go off, this would go, and my sound would start, my response would start coming down this path, and then eventually the sound reaches this other ear and starts coming down this path, and so this one gets the coincidence. And so you end up with this strategy where if I have these coincidence detectors, I can encode where the sound was coming from. So this was sketched out by Jeffress as a proposed model, 50 some odd years ago, and about 20 some odd years later, they started doing some neuroscience in this animal. So this is a barn owl. This is the same animal, the same barn owl that we saw in the video earlier. They are quite plentiful in other parts of the U.S. And what they identified in the barn owl is that in the auditory part of the midbrain, so relatively close to the ears, is this structure NL, and this structure has neurons that come in from the other side of the brain, and causes a little delay, and that causes an extra delay, and then loops around and starts spreading out over different parts of NL. And from the other ear, a different set of fibers comes in and spreads out through NL as well. And the structure of this actually corresponds very similar to the Jeffress model. This structure is duplicated twice on both sides of the midbrain. And there are basically, and so these cells come in and innervate these other cells, and so each of these colors of cells basically corresponds to a coincidence detector that either prefers the sounds that came from the left side or sounds that came from the right side. And so what this means is that based on that time delay, the ITD is the interoral time difference, so based on that time delay, how strong each of those cells will respond. And so these cells end up being the major cue for whether the sound came from the left or the right. in the owl's brain. So, what about us? Is this how our brains work? It turns out, no, this isn't quite how our brains work. So they've, one thing that's nice is that because so many animals are sensitive to interval time differences, they've been able to kind of replicate these types of studies, understand some of the behavior and physiology. And it turns out that the chickens have kind of a somewhat similar, though simpler structure than the owl. Mammals, though, rely on a completely different system for getting these time delays. So rather than having these coincidence detectors, there are these very large cells in the, I can't remember what MSO stands for, but there's these very large cells and the delays end up actually coming from, largely from activity within the dendrites of this cell itself. And a difference in the time period, the time that takes a signal to go through the dendrite of this cell versus the signals from the other ear hitting the center of the cell. And geckos have an entirely different system. So they actually rely on a much more physical implementation of these delay lines that their ears, their eardrums sit outside of their mouth cavity. And so there's actually an echo sort of inside their head that triggers this difference in the activity.
The waveform spacing, is that meant to show the resolution?
Exactly. Yeah. So what's off to the left here is that what you end up with is that kind of these different strategies and these different, you know, these different implementations end up with different sensitivities. That your sensitivity and the reliability and accuracy of that can vary. So one of the fun things with owls too is that beyond just their the timing differences, most owls have really funny shaped skulls as well. So this is true for the barn owl, but the best picture I could find was from a boreal owl, and their ears are actually behind their eyes right here. Even though, you know, sometimes like with the great horned owls, you'll see those like little ear tufts. Those actually aren't ears; those are just feathers. So their ears are actually kind of right here behind their eyes, and their skulls are asymmetrical, such that one of the ears points up and the other ear points down. And so what this does is the way that it's shaped, the timing differences between the two is fairly similar. But now, based on whether the critter, whatever it is that they're after, is sort of above their head or below their head, it changes the volume that reaches each ear. So it basically, so if I'm an owl looking for that, you know, that critter in the snow, and I dip my head down a little bit, then that critter's gonna be louder in my right ear than in my left ear. And if I tilt my head up a little bit, then now the critter's gonna be louder in my left ear than it is in my right ear. And what this gives them is it ends up being that basically the space around them, each of these circles is sort of the field of view in front of them, that as the sound source goes to the left or the right, or up or down, you get different time delays to the left and the right, and their ear shape kind of manipulates the time delays at the really high up and really high down, really far down. But it also causes this gradient, this change in volumes from up to down. So between the two, between the difference in volume and the difference in time, that gives the owl a very detailed sense of where the mouse or where the critter is in the space around them, in front of them.
There's other sounds going on too. How do they discern?
Yeah.
The wind noise especially.
Yeah, no, absolutely. This is, I mean, so this is a, I don't know specifically for owls. So what I know, so one of the researchers that's done most of the work, most of the work on owls in the last 5 or 10 years has shifted a lot of his focus of his research to attention, because that's basically becomes a critical piece of this, is being able to attend to individual sounds. We have, there's been a lot of neuroscience work done on spatial attention, visual attention. So if I'm looking at something and how I, you know, move my eyes to what I'm attending to, or if I'm looking at you but actually like trying to understand and pay attention to what somebody over here, somebody over there is doing. There's been a lot of neuroscience work done on that, largely in primates. But in the auditory world, it's, I think, an even bigger interesting question, an interesting challenge. In humans, they call it the cocktail party problem. This idea that you're like at a cocktail party, there's lots of people talking, and you're kind of switching between, you either want to filter out everybody around you to focus on this one person, then you hear somebody mention your name, right? And you want to like pretend like you're still talking to this person, but actually figure out what they're saying. Or if you're in an orchestra, right, you know that you need to like, you know that a piece of, you know, part of the song is coming up, and you need to listen to that person over there because that's going to be your cue for where you're at, right? This idea that we are constantly switching between where we're focusing our attention. And yeah, I think you're exactly right that the animals are facing the exact same sets of challenges. I don't know specifically the answer to your question of how owls manage that, but it's a common set of challenges.
Is that part of the problem with somebody with hearing aids? It's usually only in one ear.
Yeah.
So they get everything, and that's what they say.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you can't filter.
It's really hard to filter. And hearing aids really, really mess up our ability to do this kind of localization. And we rely on that localization also a lot for that filtering. That's exactly. And there's a few researchers that are actively working on this. It also gets compounded with echoes. Echoes really, you know, everything that we were kind of talking about, you know, so far assumes that this mouse's sound isn't bouncing off the tree over here or other things around. So there's also like additional processing that has to happen in order to filter out all of those echoes and all that extraneous information, which then becomes very hard with hearing aids. So let's see. So one of the other things that I think is really especially interesting with owls, if we jump back to this picture again. So owls are, so if you reflect on this owl versus that kestrel, what are kind of the other differences that you see in their face, in the shape of their skull? Yeah.
Their feathers kind of direct sound to their ears.
Yeah, so their feathers kind of face forward. Yep.
Are the eyes bigger?
The eyes are a little bit bigger. I mean, kestrels have huge eyes for the size of their head, right? But with owls in particular, the eyes are like dead forward, right? Like with the kestrels, they were kind of off to the side, but the owls, it's dead forward. With primates, and when we want to look at something, we can keep our head still and look somewhere else, right? Owls can't do that. So their eyes are basically stuck in their head. They don't really move. They don't move around when they're trying to focus. If they want to look at something new, their whole head moves. But what that means is that combining that with their, you know, these feathers and the shape of their skull, is that their eyes and their ears are always locked. They're perfectly locked spatially to orienting towards the same thing. So this map of auditory space that they can build up in front of them is perfectly aligned with the map of visual space that they have in front of them as well. And that is true down at the neural level. So this is a side view of an owl brain. Down here would be like the brain stem. This area through here is the midbrain. Back here is the cerebellum, just like we have a cerebellum. Up here is sort of like the cortex, like the owl's version of the cortex. And so in these diagrams, they have sliced through this part of the owl's brain. So this is kind of what the layout looks like. And those coincidence detectors that I was talking about, basically they come into this area, the ICC. And so here are the coincidence detectors for no difference. Here's the coincidence detectors for a 20 degree offset, a 40 degree offset. And this area ICC lines up with the optic tectum, which is the visual portion of inputs into the owl's brain. And in the owl's brain, these are perfectly aligned. They're perfectly lined up with one another. And so they've even, you know, some of the work that's been done has been to say, okay, well, how does this come about, right? Is this just did all this just wire up de novo, just by virtue of the genetic program that wired everything up in the brain, or did the owl have to learn this? And so one of the things that you can do is that the scientists have done is basically put prism goggles on owls in the lab, and given them time to adjust, and so these goggles basically shift their entire field of view by like 20 degrees. So what they thought, you know, so if it's actually right here, it's going to look like it's over here. And when they do that, this area of the brain rewires so that all of the auditory portions properly correspond to the new visual information. So this whole area of the owl midbrain is tightly locked and super reliable, so that the owl can reliably switch between visual and auditory cues to understand where things are that it's hunting for. So what happens if you're very small? So when we think about these differences in levels of timing and levels, what happens when you're very small to these cues? So if I'm an owl and it takes a certain amount of time, you know, if it's a little bit longer for a sound to get to my left ear than my right ear, if I'm tiny, like if I'm a cricket, it's going to take even less time. So that means I either need to be super crazy precise neurally, like my neural circuitry needs to be more precise, or I need to evolve some other mechanism to deal with these challenges. So crickets, so there's a cricket on a standing on a floating ball, and it's kind of affixed so that it can't go anywhere. And this is a speaker, and there's a speaker on kind of our side as well. And this is a female cricket, and in the speaker they're playing male cricket song, and the female one is trying to get to the male cricket song. To the male cricket.
Female crickets hear recordings of a male calling song and respond to it by walking on a trackball toward the direction of the sound. Similar experiments have been used to work out which song patterns females prefer and which patterns they ignore.
So the female crickets have very specific patterns that they're looking for, right, to find more attractive mates or mates that are more fit for, more fit. And so this paradigm has been used in order to try to understand what the, what types of song they like. But they still face this fundamental challenge that they have, the ability to measure, to sense left from right, but it becomes more challenging because they're so small. So one of the ways that they, there's a couple of interesting ways that they deal with this challenge. So this is a katydid, actually, which is related to crickets, and this is the best picture I could find online, that's why I got a picture of a katydid. But the arrows are pointing to their ears, actually. So in katydids, crickets, and grasshoppers, they're actually up on the thorax. But one of the ways that they deal with this challenge is that their ears aren't on the sides of their head, they're further out. And the upper part of their leg is actually hollow, and they have another kind of eardrum back, further back. And so the sound travels up their legs in order to, and so that's how they get these distances further apart from one another. And in addition to, so those little holes that we saw is this IT. And then there's a different membrane that's further up, kind of up by the thorax. And it's all, the sound pressure gradient can come throughout all of this. One of the difference in distance, though, even though it's helpful, it's still not quite enough for time. But they also now have a trade-off that there's not as much of a shadow. When we were talking about humans with the volume differences, it was like the shadow of the head. With the owls, it's the shadow that's imposed by the skull. But what this ends up doing is that on each side, by virtue of basically having kind of like two eardrums, or it's like two sides of the same eardrum, the level differences cause these weird interactions inside, that if I have a loud sound that's coming from the left-hand side here, it will first cause this to vibrate, and then cause this to vibrate. These two sound waves coming from these vibrations interact with each other, and they end up canceling out more on the far side of the sound than the near side of the sound. So it's actually through the echoes and that they're basically happening within the legs of the cricket that these sound differences are emerging for the cricket so that they can orient and find their mates. So then the final set of critters that I want to talk about are these guys. So these are the ultimate sound localizers. So there's something like 1,000 some odd different species of bats. The vast majority of them hunt insects, and they have some very interesting strategies for doing so.
Fountains Abbey in Yorkshire is a good place to watch hunting bats in action, including one of the most common, Dorbenton's bat, also known as the water bat. Old stone bridges are a favorite roost. The water bat chirps aren't exactly subtle. At 110 decibels, it makes more racket than a road drone. But like us, most of the insects it hunts can't hear ultrasound. As the bat homes in, its squeaks speed up. Insects have been bat prey since the dinosaurs were here, and some have got wise to the hunter's tricks. This moth has ears tuned direct to bat frequency. And lightning reactions to help it dodge attack. Power diving is a common moth escape
technique. Alright. There's more cool stuff in this video. We can watch it later. So with bats, there's two main strategies that bats take in their hunting echolocation calls. So the water bat that we just heard about is a frequency modulated bat. So their chirps, their echolocation calls are these sweeps that kind of sweep through. So these plots, sorry, this is time on the x-axis, and then frequency on the y-axis. So there's a pitch for a vibe. And so these chirps go from like high frequency down to low frequency, and as they get closer to the insect, they increase these their speed. There are another set of bats that are these constant frequency and then frequency modulated bats that have chirps that are constant frequency with a little blip at the end. And they also, as they get closer to their prey, slow down a little bit.
I have a question about that video. Yeah. It said that humans can't hear it. Were they making it so we could hear it by changing the frequency lower
yes.
in the video?
Yeah, exactly.
So that would have been silent to us.
That would have been utterly silent to us.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. This is, yeah, so this is, so this, these plots are up to 100 kilohertz. If you are a teenager, you can hear up to maybe like 25 kilohertz. And as we get older, our high frequency hearing goes away. This is part of why, a few years ago, I don't know if kids these days still have them, but they would have special cell phone rings that were super high frequency, so their teachers didn't know that their friends were sending them messages. Hope I didn't give you any ideas. our hearing is definitely down in these lower registers. I'm not sure if, yeah, I don't know if maybe some of the bats we can like maybe ever so slightly hear a little bit of them. But yeah, they're largely way above our hearing. The field studies to be able to do these recordings have to have very specialized sound equipment in order to record that, because we also the recording devices that we use for most recording are basically constrained to like music and speech. So you have to have a very specialized device in order to get the high frequency stuff as well. Yeah. So given that this is, so we know that, I think it's general knowledge that bats are hunting by virtue of echolocation. So they're relying on the echo that they hear back from the world around them. So if these are the sounds that they're making, what kind of information is in the echo that the bat can use in order to figure out where it's going? Any thoughts?
The sound off objects in space?
Yeah, so the sound bounces off the object. So they made a sound, it bounces off, and so we get, we get some localization in direction, largely using kind of some of the same cues that we were just talking about. The bat then also gets distance based on how long it takes that echo to come back. And for these bats in particular, these CF-FM bats, they have an extra cool trick. So as you're going after this moth, one of the things that you want to know is whether it's flying towards you or whether it's flying away from you. And so there's evidence for this in the acoustics as well. So I think everybody has experienced, standing on a street, or you're in your car, you hear the siren coming, you pull off to the side of the road, It's, you know, it's super high pitched as it comes at you, comes towards you, and then after it goes past you, you hear the frequency drop of the siren. And so that is based on what they call the Doppler effect. So as this as this sound source is creating sound, those sound waves are kind of compressing in front of them, which ends up increasing the frequency of those sound waves to a listener, and the sound waves get stretched out behind them, which decreases the frequency. And what's cool is that these bats can actually get information about the velocity of the target in that Doppler shift. And so the way that this works, so this is the mustached bat is the one that has been studied the most extensively in this area. So these pulses that are labeled CF, these are the pulses that the bat is creating. And CF is the constant frequency portion. FM is the frequency modulated portion, so this portion that kind of goes boom. And all this on the left, these first things, is the pulse that the bat creates, and then here is a drawing of the echo. And so the bat pushes out this pulse, and so this time delay between the frequency modulated portion and its echo, that gives the bat information about how far away the target is. But then the echo itself changes pitch, because the echo itself changes pitch on the for the constant frequency portion of its vocalization. That gives the bat information about whether the moth is flying towards it or flying away from it. And so in this example, the echo is higher frequency than the bat. So this means that the moth is coming towards the bat. What's interesting, I've probably said that like 12 times. One of the really interesting things is that as with basically all sound that we create, as with our vocalizations, the sound that comes from a viola or a clarinet or an oboe, there are multiple harmonics of any given pitch. It's very rare that we have a pure tone, a pure pitch that is only that tone. There are harmonics up in the higher registers that come out of virtue of the echoes of the and the nature of the whatever the device is that's creating the sound. So this is true for bats as well. They might have a particular pitch that they are producing, but there are higher frequency components, higher harmonics in their vocalization. And the mustache bats rely exclusively on the second harmonic of the vocalization in order to detect the echoes of what they are listening for. And this second harmonic is typically in a frequency range of, I wrote in my notes right here, 61 to 61.5 kilohertz, so much higher than human hearing. And they have a few different parts of their brain that are specialized for these challenges. So they have an entire part of their brain that scientists very cleverly call FMFM, which is the comparison of the timing between the frequency modulated portions that gives them a sense of the distance. This CF-CF portion, that's the delta, the difference between these constant frequencies, so that gives them the Doppler information, the velocity information. And then, like us, they have a primary auditory cortex that just responds to sounds of different frequencies. But they have this big bulbous area of their auditory cortex that is very specifically tuned and can pick up the slightest changes in frequencies in this range that they're listening for those Doppler shifts. So they, so these Doppler shifts, and so what they do is that because this is such a narrow range, that they have super high precision. Their brains are super well tuned to the slightest deviation in these frequencies. Is that as they are going in to get their moth, they start to adjust their own pitch, low or high, so that the echo stays within this range.
Wow.
So rather than keeping their own vocalization at one level and listening to where the pitches are going above and below, they're constantly adjusting their own frequency in order to keep the echo frequency within the certain range that they can be super sensitive to.
Besides using this to catch the lunch,
yeah.
Do they use it to communicate with each other?
They do, yeah. So they have, bats are, have a lot of social calls, a lot of social vocalizations, and a bunch of those are happening in this sound range as well. And yes.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So swarm of bats come out,
uh-huh.
Bugs flying around. Why do they not collide with one another all out after the same moth?
Yeah.
Why are there not crashes in the air constantly between bats? I mean, I see this moth, looks really good, other guy over here's going, hey, cool moth over there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How's
that working?
I don't know.
It's magic.
Well, it's not, this is focusing on the moth stuff. You know, there's the researchers that one of the things that you see often in particularly in neuroscience research, is that once you start to kind of, once you have an animal that is amenable to working with in the lab, so that you can actually start to do some of these studies, you can start to tweak these like frequency things. You got your like room in the lab set up, and you can get the animal chasing a moth. Then you can start to tweak things, and you can say, okay, well, how's the bat dealing with barriers in the environment? And so people have done some of this work kind of with static barriers, where you start like dropping string, you have strings hanging from the ceiling, and seeing how the bats navigate through this. And they're incredibly sensitive to it. They in those kinds of environments, they're very good at dodging the slightest strings that are very tiny that they can swoop around. So I don't know exactly. It becomes much more of a challenge like answering that question when you have lots of bats that are interacting. Social dynamics in general is a very hard problem to get experimental traction on. But I think what I've shown for you right here is kind of drilling down and reducing down into two very subtle, very specific auditory cues that they can use for one specific use. But there's all kinds of other cues in their environment that they're relying on. Cues for the size of what they're going after, its own motion and fluttering. Some bats are able to be sensitive to the type of moth that they're pursuing based on the wing beats. Different types of, there's that water bat earlier, it needs to know that it's going after, that it's gonna go down and drink water and not that it's gonna go down and slam into like a piece of asphalt, right? So bats are highly sensitive and are collecting a lot of information from their environment from these echoes. So I think some of the key takeaways of that I'd like for you to kind of go away with today is that in general a lot of animals are relying on these differences in level and sound level and sound timing to have sensitivity for whether things are kind of to their left or their right. And yet, certainly birds and mammals have kind of different circuitry to handle some of these challenges. And when you start looking at animals that, like owls, that rely on where you know, localization becomes even more critical to their behavior, we see increasingly refinement of those neural circuitry in order to be able to support those needs. Crickets hear with their legs, which I just think is awesome and amazing. That even though we have, you know, kind of going back to this idea of levels of analysis, right? That there's still this common need between humans and crickets to identify the sources of sounds in our environment, but some radically different approaches to how we've evolved to solve those challenges. And bats, in particular, have these, further specializations for distance and velocity, that I think is a fascinating interaction between their own motion and their own, adjusting their own vocalizations in order to make sure that the echoes line up with the portions of their circuitry that they can, that are well tuned to those echoes. So thank you very much. I don't have an open-ended thank you and question slide, which I should. So thank you very much for chatting with me.